Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, December 17th, 2021. President Joe Biden telling the graduating class at a historically black college in South Carolina on voting rights bills being held up by Senate Republicans, this battle is not over. We're going to keep up the fight until we get it done. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer confirming that the Democrats' almost $2 trillion social spending and climate bill will not be passed before Christmas, as he originally wanted. He says it's to give more time for negotiations with Senate Democratic holdouts, the moderates, especially Joe Manchin. White House warning the unvaccinated can expect a winter of severe illness and death from the Omicron variant of COVID-19. And they also say it's expected to be the dominant strain in a matter of weeks, urging the unvaccinated to get protected now. Retiring National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins reflecting on the low state of public confidence in the U.S. government in handling crises like the pandemic. And Roger Stone, longtime friend and ally of former President Donald Trump, appears before the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and invokes his constitutional Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself to every question asked. Later, outside, he told reporters the committee is Witch Hunt 3.0. From CNN, President Joe Biden on Friday pledged to keep up the fight to pass voting rights legislation that remains stalled in Congress due to Republican opposition as he delivered the commencement address at a historically black university in South Carolina. The president urged Congress to pass two democratically sponsored bills, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act that Senate Republicans have blocked. The two bills are aimed at fighting voter suppression, making it easier to register to vote, making Election Day a public holiday, ensuring states have early voting for federal elections, and allowing all voters to request mail-in ballots, among other provisions. That reporting from CNN. The president was at South Carolina State University in Orangeburg.
I've never seen anything like the unrelenting assault on the right to vote. Never. I don't think any of you have on this stage ever seen it. Not a joke. And folks, you know, as John Lewis said, it is the only, without the right to vote, there is no democracy. It's not just about who gets to vote or making it easier as we used to try to do to make people eligible to be able to vote. It's about who gets to count the vote, whether your vote counts at all. Folks, I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee for a long time. At the end of my stint, before I became vice president, I was able to pass the extension of the Voting Rights Act for 25 years, and guess what? And convince Strom Thurmond of South Carolina to vote for it. No, not a joke. I thought we're finally beginning to move. But this new sinister combination of voter suppression and election subversion, it's un-American. It's undemocratic, and sadly, it is unprecedented since Reconstruction. Vice President Harris is leading the efforts for us, but on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, I directed every single federal agency in the United States government to promote access to voting, and each agency is heading and heeding the call. For example, the Department of Veterans Affairs is going to make it easier for veterans and their families to register to vote. You know why? Because we're going to use VA facilities, and they're going to open them up for everybody, and nobody's going to stop anybody. But across the board, in addition, the Justice Department, my Justice Department has doubled the voting rights enforcement staff, challenging the onslaught of state laws undermining the right to vote. We've supported Democrats fighting for voting rights bills since day one of our administration, making sure that we have unanimous support among Democrats in the Senate, which we do. But each and every time it gets to be brought up, that other team blocks the ability even to start to discuss it. That other team. What used to be called the Republican Party. But this battle's not over. We must pass the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We must. And we're going to keep up the fight until we get it done, and you're going to keep up the fight, and we need your help badly.
President Biden giving the commencement address at South Carolina State University in Orangeburg. He He also pledged to continue to pursue police reform. Senate negotiations between Republicans and Democrats on that issue were called off this past summer when no compromise was reached. The president was introduced today by the U.S. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, a Democrat of South Carolina, the highest-ranking black lawmaker in Congress, who graduated from this university in 1961 and was a crucial early supporter of Joe Biden for president ahead of the pivotal South Carolina primary election. State newspaper explains out of Columbia, South Carolina, that 60 years ago, Jim Clyburn finished his studies at the state's only publicly funded black college. He had taken all his history courses at the school and had earned a Bachelor of Arts degree, but the college at the time didn't have graduation ceremonies in December, instead only offering the ceremony in the spring, so his diploma was mailed to him. Well, today, Jim Clyburn was able to walk across the stage with 128 other graduating students and received his diploma from the President of the United States. More from the CNN article on voting rights. The Republican opposition has prompted progressive Democrats and activists to demand changes to the Senate filibuster rule, which requires 60 votes to advance most legislation. But Democrats don't have the votes they need in the chamber to end the filibuster rule because they face opposition within their own party, including from Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. In Washington, D.C. today on the Senate floor, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer with an update.
The fight to protect voting rights and restore the United States Senate is moving forward. Yesterday, I continued to have detailed discussions with many of my colleagues about how we're going to reach our goal of passing voting rights to ensure it takes effect before Americans return to the polls in the next election, so it can affect those 2022 elections, which Republican legislators are so jaundicing. Last night, a number of my colleagues and I met with Marty Payone, a Senate rules expert who worked under several previous majority leaders, including Robert C. Byrd, about how we can restore the Senate so it can work the way our founders intended, the way it has functioned for generations before the Republican gridlock of the past decade or so. Just now, I came from a meeting where both Marty Payone and Marty Gold, one a Democrat, one a Republican, counsel, discussing how we can move forward on these issues, making the Senate work and getting voting rights done. Later today, Marty will join the Senate Democrats at our caucus meeting to discuss to continue this very important conversation. Marty Payone will. We've tried all year long to get Republicans to join us on a bipartisan effort to protect our democracy, but they've resisted and they have blocked the Senate from having so much as a debate on this issue. A debate, not even a debate. Four votes. On three of them, every Republican voted not even to go forward in debate, and on the fourth vote, only one. Of course, under the rules of the Senate, as they're presently constituted, you need 10. Voting rights should not be a partisan issue. Both parties are better off if our democracy is strong and safeguarded against the Republican assaults playing out at the state level. The voting restrictions we are seeing passed in Republican-dominated state legislatures are the most egregious assaults on voting rights since the days of Jim Crow, and they are being passed entirely on a party-line basis. Zero bipartisanship from these state legislator Republicans. And here in the Senate, we're going to keep at it, because just because Republicans will not join us does not mean Democrats will stop fighting on this issue. It's too important, and the fight continues.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor today. TheHill.com writes that Democrats have been having discussions about how to potentially change the rules, with a range of options on the table, including exempting voting rights from the 60-vote filibuster, implementing a talking filibuster, or requiring 41 no votes rather than 60 yes votes in an effort to put more pressure on senators blocking legislation. The U.S. House Representative is not in session today or expected for the rest of the year, but the House Administration's Subcommittee on Elections held a hearing titled Member Day, inviting members of Congress to testify about voting and election reforms they support. The ranking Republican on the subcommittee is Brian Stile of Wisconsin. In his opening statement, he gave his views on voting rights legislation that's been passed by the House and being considered in the Senate. And he begins, though, by pointing out he wished the hearing had been at the full committee level so other issues could be examined.
House rules state that during the first session of the 117th Congress, each standing committee or each subcommittee thereof shall hold a hearing in which it receives testimony from members, delegates, and resident commissioners on proposed legislation within its jurisdiction. Today, 348 days into the session, Chair Lofgren is just now fulfilling this requirement, but chose to do so without the full committee. This requirement is being fulfilled by our subcommittee on elections. Oversight of federal election is important and a key piece of this committee's jurisdiction. But elections are only a fraction of what members should be able to speak to during a true members' hearing day. We should be able to speak that the Capitol, the People's House, is not open for tours. It is not open to the people. We should be able to talk about mask requirements on the House floor. We should be able to talk about metal detectors for members of Congress. But today we're having a hearing on the Friday before Christmas. It's almost like you'd think the Democrats are trying to hide something from their public about the bad policies of their legislation. Kind of like they did in rushing through H.R. 1, the federal government takeover of elections, over 800 pages of a one-size-fits-all mandate to states and localities on every minute detail of how elections should be operated. H.R. 1, as we know, would have gutted voter ID laws. H.R. 1 would have nationalized elections, would have restricted states' abilities to maintain accurate voter rolls, and would have provided a handout to politicians with a 6-to-1 match of small donations funded with taxpayer money. This process is now repeating itself in the Senate, where they're trying to pass a, quote, compromise voting bill right now, just before the end of the year, just before Christmas, when nobody's watching. But really, the bill in debate in the Senate is just a shorter version of H.R. 1 and would mandate that mail-in ballots be accepted if they're received 7 days after the election. It would weaken states' voter ID requirements. It would mandate automatic voter registration. And it would nationalize our election system and centralize the administration in Washington, D.C.
Congressman Brian Stile is ranking Republican on the House Administration Subcommittee on Elections. His opening statement during today's hearing. Well, one of the members of Congress who testified at today's Member Day hearing was the main sponsor of H.R. 1. The Democrats called it the For the People Act. John Sarbanes of Maryland, he also chairs the Democracy Reform Task Force.
As you know, the American public is calling on Congress to take action to protect and expand the right to vote, increase government transparency, and safeguard the integrity of our democratic institutions. This House rose to the occasion in March, passing H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which is now being considered in the Senate, where it has been reformulated as the Freedom to Vote Act. Then in August, we passed H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, as well. Taken together, these transformational bills will promote clean and fair elections, end the dominance of big money in our politics, and ensure the voice of the people is fairly represented in Congress, as well as strengthening key protections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Earlier, it was said that the Senate work on this bill now is happening while no one is watching. I would argue everyone is watching. The American people are watching with great expectations and hope that we will get this democracy reform over the finish line. It was also said that H.R. 1 is a partisan bill. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you look at the polling out there, Americans of all political stripes, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, support the reforms that are contained in H.R. 1. There's nothing really controversial in the bill. What's controversial is it's taken us this long to get it into this comprehensive package that can lift up our democracy and that we haven't actually gotten it passed yet. That's what we are trying to do as we speak.
Congressman John Sarbanes, a witness at today's House Administration Subcommittee hearing on voting and election reform. Now to the nearly $2 trillion social spending and climate plan known as Build Back Better. Senate Democrats have been hoping to get it passed by Christmas. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer acknowledging today that is not going to happen, that more time is needed to get the final few moderate Senate Democrats to agree to a final package. In the end, for anything to pass, with Democratic votes alone expected, since all Senate Republicans so far have been against this, Every senator in the Senate Democratic Caucus will need to vote yes. Here is Senator Schumer.
Mr. President, Senate Democrats are working to pass Build Back Better and send it to the president's desk as soon as possible so we can strengthen the middle class, create opportunity in the 21st century, and fight the climate crisis. Yesterday, I had a good discussion with the president and the speaker where we talked about ongoing negotiations on finalizing the Build Back Better Act so we can pass it through the Senate. The president requested more time to continue his negotiations. And so we will keep working with him, hand in hand, to bring this bill over the finish line and deliver on these much-needed provisions. At its core, Build Back Better is about making the greatest investment in the American people that we have seen in generations. It's about building new ladders to help people climb into the middle class and providing them stability to thrive in the middle class once they get there. That means lowering the cost of prescription drugs, extending the child tax credit, making childcare more affordable for tens of millions of families, expanding housing, early education, and affordable health care. And it means taking unprecedented steps to fight climate change and lay the groundwork for greater action in the future. These are all things that the American people want. These are things Democrats are fighting to secure. And it cannot be forgotten that not a single Republican, not one, has joined us in making them happen.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The Build Back Better bill, which the Democrats are putting together, includes currently an extension of the expanded child tax credit, which Democrats approved earlier this year as part of the coronavirus relief package. The current credit expires at the end of the year, so without an extension, there will be no payments in January to the estimated 35 million families with children who are qualifying. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters today the president is considering doubling the size of February's payments, if a bill can be finished by then, to compensate. With Build Back Better off the table, the only main thing left for the Senate to finish before the holiday recess is a large batch of State Department nominations and a couple of judicial nominations. And that is taking a lot of time because a few Senate Republicans have been holding up the State Department people, demanding votes on certain foreign policy issues in exchange for letting the votes on the nominations go through quickly. Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, spoke about this on the Senate floor today.
I rise to express my support for a number of foreign affairs nominations that should receive not just cloture votes today, but should receive votes on their nomination. It's a long list, including Dr. Atul Gawande to be the Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Global Health at the United States Agency for International Development. Mark Gitenstein to be the U.S. Ambassador to the European Union. Julissa Reynoso Pantelon to be the Ambassador to Spain. Rahm Emanuel to be the Ambassador to Japan. Governor Jack Markell to be the U.S. Representative to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Marcela Escobari to be Assistant Administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean at USAID, and Mark Knapper to be the Ambassador to Vietnam. Just think about it, Mr. President. Think about these assignments. Think about these assignments and what they mean to the United States. These are quality nominees, people who will represent the United States at home and abroad with skill and dignity. I appreciate the majority leader has made it a priority to confirm them prior to the end of the session, and I encourage all of my colleagues to support their nomination. But let's face it, there's little to celebrate when it comes to nominations in the Senate. The truth is that some Republicans' unprecedented obstructionism is straining the system to the breaking point, leaving the president without a team of national security positions that are critical to the national security and interests of the United States and the American people, leaving our nation weakened.
Senator Bob Menendez, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, on the Senate floor. Among those Republican senators with holds on the nominations, Ted Cruz of Texas. He is seeking a vote to sanction Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. and Josh Hawley of Missouri, who says he's upset over the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, how that was handled. Again, it's not that these senators can prevent the Democratic majority from confirming the nominations, but they can slow down the process considerably. Senator Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, speaking on the floor in defense of her Republican colleagues. And then she also comments about the Senate Democrats delaying the social spending and climate Build Back Better bill.
As Tennesseans have turned on the news this week, they've heard an avalanche of news reports holding one or two members of this body responsible for, and I'm quoting, obstructing the democratic process. Something that sounds pretty scary when it's taken out of context, isn't it? And in my opinion, I consider it media malpractice to blame one or two members of this chamber for a year's worth of bad faith delays because members have asked for a vote on certain national security issues, and the Senate should have weighed in on these issues long ago. The Senate has had the time. The leadership has had the time. So, no, that narrative cannot stand. As these delays and all this strife is the natural conclusion of the Democrats' single-minded obsession with their reckless tax and spending spree. My colleagues on the left have indeed squandered months trying to strong-arm their moderate colleagues into rubber-stamping what I call their Build Back Broke agenda. So it is so toxic that even economists who many times, Madam President, are friendly with the White House have turned their backs on the proposal. Even they deem it socialist in nature. And this month, we have reaped the consequences of their obsession in the form of 6.8% inflation. It's already at a 40-year high. It's still ticking up. Gas prices are increasing. Food is costing more. Warehouses are being cleared out. 170 cargo ships are still off the coast of California, 150 miles out. But yet, until a few hours ago, really, the Democrats were pushing for final passage on a spending bill that would make things even worse. Would make it worse. It's not $1.75 trillion. It is $5 trillion. It's not paid for. It's not, oh, it doesn't cost a dime. It costs $3 trillion. That's the conservative estimate.
Senator Marsha Blackburn on the Senate floor today. And one more note about the Democrats' Build Back Better bill. The Senate parliamentarian Thursday night rejecting the most recent plan for including immigration reform, saying it does not meet the criteria for the budget process that's being used. Again, that process allows Democrats to pass a bill on their own because it can't be filibustered by Republicans. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki telling reporters on Air Force One, the decision by the parliamentarian is deeply disappointing and relegates millions to an uncertain and frightening future. The president, the administration, and our partners on the Hill vehemently disagree with this decision and will keep fighting to give relief and protection to the many Dreamers, TPS holders, farm workers, and essential workers who are living in fear. She was asked whether the Senate should then overrule the parliamentarian, Psaki saying the White House is not advocating that. But she said, I am just suggesting we support our efforts to get immigration reform done. On Wall Street today, the Dow falling 532 points, NASDAQ down 10, S&P down 48. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now app and wherever you get your podcasts. Turning to coronavirus, this from WashingtonPost.com. Hospitalizations are rising across much of the United States, leading public health officials to warn that a winter surge caused by both the Delta and Omicron variants could have devastating outcomes. Nationwide, hospitalizations increased by about 3% and deaths rose by about 7% over the past week. But some regions are seeing a much steeper rise. The White House COVID-19 response team holding a virtual briefing today. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is CDC director.
The current 7-day daily average of cases is at about 119,500 per day. The 7-day average of hospital admissions is at about 7,800 per day, an increase of about 4% over the prior week. And the 7-day average of daily deaths is at about 1,200 per day, which is at an increase of over 8% from the prior week. Now let me bring you up to date on what we know about Omicron. At least 39 states and over 75 countries have reported confirmed cases of the Omicron variant. And although Delta continues to circulate widely in the United States, Omicron is increasing rapidly, and we expect it to become the dominant strain in the United States, as it has in other countries, in the coming weeks. We've seen cases of Omicron among those who are both vaccinated and boosted, and we believe these cases are milder or asymptomatic because of vaccine protection. What we do know is we have the tools to protect ourselves against COVID-19. We have vaccines, we have boosters, and we know multi-layer prevention strategies, masks in public indoor settings, practicing physical distancing, frequent hand washing, improving ventilation, and testing to slow transmission are vitally important, especially as we prepare for more Omicron, and even if you are vaccinated and boosted.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky is director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Leading today's virtual news conference, Jeff Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, who used starker language, similar to what President Biden did last night, about what is in store this winter for those who don't take precautions against infection and those who do.
As we've explained in prior briefings, the Omicron variant is more transmissible, and our medical experts anticipate it will lead to a rise in cases. But unlike last winter, we now have the power to protect ourselves. Our vaccines work against Omicron, especially for people who get booster shots when they are eligible. If you are vaccinated, you could test positive. But if you do get COVID, your case will likely be asymptomatic or mild. We are intent on not letting Omicron disrupt work and school for the vaccinated. You've done the right thing, and we will get through this. For the unvaccinated, you're looking at a winter of severe illness and death for yourselves, your families, and the hospitals you may soon overwhelm. So our message to every American is clear. There is action you can take to protect yourself and your family. Wear a mask in public indoor settings. Get vaccinated. Get your kids vaccinated. And get a booster shot when you're eligible. We are prepared to confront this new challenge. We have plenty of vaccines and booster shots available at convenient locations and for no cost. There's clear guidance on masking to help slow the spread. And we have emergency medical teams to respond to surges as necessary. So this is not a moment to panic, because we know how to protect people and we have the tools to do it. But we need the American people to do their part.
Jeff Zients is White House COVID-19 response coordinator. A few other headlines from the briefing. CDC Director Dr. Walensky saying she stands by an advisory committee's decision to keep Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine on the market, despite a rare but serious side effect that has caused blood clots in some people. She says, given the current state of the pandemic, both here and around the world, any vaccination is better than no vaccination. And she also says that more than 5 million children in the U.S. under the age of 11 have now been vaccinated, and the safety data shows no serious safety concerns. Also today, Pfizer and BioNTech saying they expect to submit an application for use of their COVID-19 vaccine in children under 5 years old in the first half of 2022. Currently, under 5 is the only age group that has no approved COVID-19 vaccines. And the CEO of Southwest Airlines, Gary Kelly, says that he has tested positive for COVID-19. This comes days after he testified before the Senate Commerce Committee, sitting beside other airline CEOs, all without masks. A spokesperson for Southwest saying that Kelly has been fully vaccinated, received his booster earlier this year, and that he tested multiple times negative before the hearing and then ultimately tested positive after returning home. Dr. Francis Collins has been director of the National Institutes of Health for 12 years, and he's retiring at the end of this year, just a couple of weeks. Today he was interviewed by Washington Post senior writer Frances Stead Sellers, and she asked about a survey about American views on the government and how they can handle or not handle response to a crisis like the pandemic.
There was a recent report from the Global Health Security Index that placed the United States number one in some ways in terms of biomedical and other things advances, but rated it very, very low in terms of confidence in the government, which is so critical to public health. What do you make of that, and what do you think we can do about it?
You know, that's very troubling, and I'm not too surprised. I mean, look around us at everything you see, particularly in social media or just in interactions with family and friends. We have in this country fallen into this divisive kind of set of tribal attitudes, and much of that does seem to reflect, in some of those tribes at least, deep distrust of the government, oftentimes whipped up by conspiracies that have no basis in fact, but spread like wildfire through social media. Yeah, we're in trouble, I think, as a society. We seem to have lost, in many ways, our anchor to truth and to sizing up a claim by whether there's any evidence behind it. And instead, it sort of depends on which tribe we're in, which information we hear, and which information we internalize. And oftentimes that information isn't right. And certainly for me as a scientist, this is deeply troubling. And you've seen it play out, of course, in the way in which with life-saving vaccines, probably some of the best vaccines that have ever been created by mankind and were created in record time, there are 50 million people who are saying no thanks, or maybe just no, because they believe that these are not going to be good for them, and much of that based upon false information. And yes, since, you know, NIH is part of the government, I'm sure distrust of government spills over onto us.
So let me ask you a little more about that. Many of those 50 million are people of faith. You are both a scientist and a man of faith, and you've tried to reach out to religious communities. What successes have you seen? Are you frustrated by the results? What has to happen now?
It's hard to tell. I have done outreach in the form of podcasts with people like Pastor Rick Warren, Franklin Graham, Tim Keller, Tom Wright. A lot of effort being made on the part of leaders in the Christian church to try to convince congregations and pastors who lead them that this is not something to be fearful. This is an answer to prayer. That's how I see it. And yet, again, we seem to have a circumstance now where politics has gotten all tangled up with faith traditions. And the politics seems at many times to be more dominant in the way in which it decides people's opinions as opposed to what are the basic foundations of their faith. And that's very troubling as well. This is one thing, even after I stepped down as NIH director in a couple of days, that I hope to continue to be engaged in, this importance of making sure that people of faith see science as their ally and not as a threat. Science is, in my view, a gift from God, a chance to understand how nature works and to use that to help people. And it seems like for a believer, that ought to be celebrated and embraced, but not at the moment in some instances.
NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, a program today hosted by The Washington Post. Dr. Collins has also been making music all his life. He's in a band with other NIH physicians called Affordable Rock and Roll Act. And earlier this week, he posted a farewell parody song about the pandemic to the tune of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Here's part of that.
Somewhere past the pandemic, masks will come off. No more need for a nose swab every time we cough. As we are gathered here today, COVID's toll has hit and sent us reeling. But partners like the ones right here will help to make the pathway clear to find a true healing. Somewhere past the pandemic, life will resume. We'll all complain about the traffic, forgetting how we hated Zoom.
The NIH director, Dr. Francis Collins, at least for a few more days until he retires. You can find the full video of that song on Twitter. Dr. Collins stepping down from his post at the end of the month after 12 years as NIH director under Presidents Obama, Trump, and now first year of Biden. Longtime Trump confidant Roger Stone, writes Associated Press, says he has asserted his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination in an interview with the House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The committee subpoenaed Stone last month, noting that he spoke at rallies on the day before the insurrection and used members of a far-right extremist group, the Oath Keepers, as personal security guards while he was in Washington. Several members of that militia group broke into the Capitol on January 6th, along with hundreds of other supporters of former President Donald Trump, and have been charged with conspiring to block the certification of the vote. That's how AP put it. Roger Stone, after he was inside with the committee, came outside and spoke with reporters.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning, in fulfillment of a federal subpoena, I did my civic duty and I responded as required by law. I did invoke my Fifth Amendment rights to every question, not because I have done anything wrong, but because I am fully aware of the House Democrats' long history of fabricating perjury charges on the basis of comments that are innocuous, immaterial, or irrelevant. I question the legitimacy of this inquiry based on the fact that Speaker Pelosi rejected the appointment of Republicans to this committee and seated two anti-Trump Republicans. This is Witch Hunt 3.0. If the Speaker was seriously interested in getting to the bottom of what happened on January 6th, she would release the thousands of hours of videotape taken by government cameras on the incidents of that day. She would also release the audio transmissions of all law enforcement agencies on that day. I stress yet again that I was not on the ellipse. I did not march to the Capitol. I was not at the Capitol. And any claim, assertion, or even implication that I knew about or was involved in any way whatsoever with the illegal and politically counterproductive activities of January 6th is categorically false. What disturbed me is an investigation into my activities on January 5th, which is constitutionally protected free speech, the constitutional right of free assembly, and the constitutional right to redress the government regarding grievances. I don't like to see the criminalization of constitutionally protected political activity. I think it is a slippery slope. Thank you very much, gentlemen, and have a wonderful day.
Any other legal concerns stemming at all, civil litigation, any other legal concerns, Mr. Scott?
Roger Stone, political consultant, lobbyist, ally of former President Trump, speaking with reporters. Stone was convicted in 2019 of lying to Congress in the Russia investigation, the Mueller investigation, pardoned later by President Trump. He's one of about 50 witnesses subpoenaed by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. In all, about 300 witnesses have been called before the committee. A few have refused to appear and have been held in contempt. Steve Bannon, Jeffrey Clark, Mark Meadows. Also this from AP, a Capitol rioter who attacked police officers working to hold back the angry pro-Trump mob on January 6th was sentenced Friday to more than 5 years behind bars, the most so far for anyone sentenced in the insurrection. That person, Robert Palmer, 54 years old, of Largo, Florida. He told the judge, "Your Honor, I'm really, really ashamed of what I did." The effects of the January 6th attack extend beyond the borders of the United States, according to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. He explained during an interview today, the interview covering the first year of the Biden presidency. The question will come from Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations.
You just had a democracy summit. I'd be curious to hear what you think it actually accomplished. But more broadly, what impact has January 6th had on the ability of the United States to operate in the world? I mean, when you go about your business, you meet with your foreign counterparts, the president does. How do you see it having changed the way people see the United States and as a result recalibrate to the extent they have their relationship with us?
January 6th has had a material impact on the view of the United States from the rest of the world, I believe from allies and adversaries alike. Allies look at it with concern and worry about the future of American democracy. Adversaries look at it, more sort of rubbing their hands together and thinking, how do we take advantage of this in one way or another? What President Biden has done over the course of this year is project a deep sense of confidence in what America can be and will be if we make the right investments and pursue the right course in terms of the strength and health of our democracy going forward. But he has also acknowledged, as he did in his remarks at the Democracy Summit, that these pressures on our democracy, as evidence, for example, in January 6th, are pressures democracies are feeling the world over. And that really was the fundamental purpose of pulling countries together. It was not to chest thump about a particular form of government, though we do also like to do that because we believe democracy is the best form of government. It also was to say, at this moment of challenge for democratic institutions that emanate both from within and from without, let's learn lessons from one another, let's support one another, and let's prove over the course of the next decade, as President Biden has said, that democracy will bear out over autocracy as the form of government that can best deliver in our time. But it's a topic. January 6th comes up. It comes up in conversation, and it is brought up by countries that wish us well, and it comes up by countries that wish us ill. And I think political cohesion, political stability, a common commitment across party lines to the basic institutions of American and values of American democracy, those are the kinds of things that would actually provide the kind of national security propulsion that we really need to be able to serve our interests abroad effectively.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Today's program at the Council on Foreign Relations covered many foreign policy hotspots as well, including Russia, China, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Also, Iran. Sullivan here asked whether President Biden's stated goal of getting the U.S. to rejoin the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement will happen. It was President Trump who withdrew the U.S. in 2018.
It was obviously your and your colleagues' preference, I assume it still is, that we get back, we, the United States and Iran, get back into the 2015 JCPOA. Two questions. One, how's the going? And then, and on the off chance, not so well.
Yeah.
What is the limits to our talk? As you acknowledge, Iran is well on its way. It's already in the zip code of becoming what you might call a threshold nuclear weapon state. And the amount of lead time we would have if they decided to make a sprint towards nuclear weapons has been dramatically reduced because we've seen the unraveling of the JCPOA, for the record, initiated by us with the unilateral exit by the previous administration in 2018. What are the limits to our tolerance? Does Iran understand that? Do they understand there are limits to American tolerance about their nuclear activities?
We have communicated both through the Europeans and directly to Iran our view on their continued forward progress on the program, our alarm about it. And I'm not going to say more publicly about what those precise messages are because I believe that Iran understands them, but don't want to negotiate in public on them. To your broader question on how's it going, it's not going well in the sense that we do not yet have a pathway back into the JCPOA. The last few days, I think, have brought some progress at the bargaining table, but In the meantime, since we walked away from a deal that had fundamentally put a lid on Iran's nuclear program, they have raced that program forward. And getting that program back into the box through a return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA has proven more difficult over the course of this year than we would have liked to see. And we are paying the wages of the disastrous decision to leave the deal back in 2018. That being said, what is going well is unity with our European partners, greater alignment with China and Russia, and I think an increasing recognition by Iran that it needs to come to the table in a seriously constructive way, and that our patience is by no means unlimited. I'm not going to circle a date on the calendar next week or next month, but I will say that as they continue to move their program forward, it does imperil the fundamental viability of the JCPOA over time.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Richard Haass, who is head of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former State Department official in the George W. Bush administration. You can find the video of the full program at cspan.org. Guardian newspaper in Great Britain reporting today, attempts to salvage the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are, quote, rapidly reaching the end of the road, European negotiators have warned, as talks in Vienna adjourn to allow the Iranian negotiator to return home for consultation, a pause described by the Europeans as disappointing. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories delivered right to you by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word, at c-span.org/connect. Hope you have a good night and weekend.